This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents High Voltage by Karen Marie Manning, performed by Amanda Lee Cobb and Jim Frangione.
For all you Dannys out there, ad astra per aspera. Move the stars. Rise.
Then. Men rarely, if ever, manage to dream up a god superior to themselves. Most gods have the manners and the morals of a spoiled child. Robert Heinlein. Everything you think you know is wrong. Mortals possess short lives, shorter memories. You can't even spin the same story twice without bastardizing the facts. When politics come into play, human canon becomes convenient at best, dispensed with entirely at worst. You have no bloody idea who your gods are. Conversations with Dare. I have no gods. My demons ate them. Danny O'Malley. Stardust. He wouldn't have seen the shooting star if the woman in his bed hadn't fallen asleep, overstaying her welcome, filling him with the restless desire for a solitary walk on the beach. The ocean at night always made him glad to be alive, which was why he'd chosen to live so near it. Alive was the one thing he'd always be. Tonight, the sea was a shiver of dark glass, harboring secrets untold in her depths, while on her tranquil surface stars glittered like diamonds. Life-giving, life-stealing, beautiful, a challenge to handle, worth learning to ride, full of fresh wonders every day. If he'd had a woman like the ocean in his bed, he'd still be there. He wasn't a man that believed in signs from the heavens. He'd lived too long for that and knew if he were to receive a sign of any kind, it would explode from below in a shower of sparks and brimstone, not descend from above, a wonder to behold. For a few moments he watched the star scorch a path across a black velvet sky, leaving a streak of shimmering stardust in its wake. Then he turned away and stripped off his clothes to go for a swim. He was nearly to the water when he realized the star appeared to be headed his way and was much closer than it initially appeared. In fact, it seemed, if it continued on its current path, it might land on his beach. What were the odds of that? He arched a brow, considering its trajectory. Although he couldn't gauge its velocity, the star certainly seemed to be on a direct collision course. With him. His laughter was deep, mocking. How rich that would be. After so many eons, was he to be felled by a shooting star? Had he finally managed to offend both those who resided in the heavens and those that dwelled beneath? Was his sentence finite, after all? He watched its approach, amused, daring it to find its mark, end his life, obliterate him. He growled, "Do your best," and closed his eyes, waiting for the impact. He'd seen the end come too many times to care in what guise it appeared. He didn't need to watch. He knew what death was. Never final. Not for him. He waited. And waited. Finally, he opened his eyes. The star had slowed to a crawl, and was no longer speeding across the sky, but tumbling, slowly, lazily, directly overhead, perhaps a mile above him. He didn't move a muscle. "Come on, you bitch. Do it." The star plummeted abruptly, acquiring velocity as it fell. When it crashed to the beach a dozen paces away, impact buried it in a soft explosion of sand. One brow arched, he contemplated the indentation. The only other time the universe had singled him out for attention, it hadn't gone well. He was intrigued in spite of himself. This was an unusual turn of events for a man to whom nothing was unusual anymore. and hadn't been for a very long time. Approaching the depression, he knelt and began to dig. When at last his fingers closed on the thing that had fallen from the sky, he muttered an oath and yanked his hands from the sand. It was blisteringly hot, and now it was covered again. He sat back, stretched his legs around the hollow, and excavated it more carefully, until a black chunk the size of his hand was revealed, with jagged, broken edges that glowed red as burning embers. So much for signs. So much for death. It was only a flat chunk of molten rock that had coincidentally plummeted to his beach while he'd happened to be out walking. He pushed up and began to lope toward the sea, but as he moved away from the fallen star, a sudden breeze gusted a fragrance after him that stopped him in his tracks. The monster within growled and inhaled greedily. Ah, the smell. What was that smell? He glanced back, nostrils flaring. Returning to the object, he stood above it, eyes closed, breathing hungrily, tasting the aroma with his mind. His monster was pacing now, restless and alert. Woman. The rock smelled of a woman, dark and vast, complex as the sea. She was life and death, mercy and ruthlessness, joy and grief. Complicated, hard to handle, worth learning to ride. Where had it come from? Consumed by the mystery, he opened his eyes. Although he healed with remarkable speed, he was in no mood to burn his hands again, so he stalked to a nearby tumble of rock and selected a long, narrow wedge. Returning to the far-flung star, he nudged it with the stone, working it up the side of the sandy indentation so he could flip it over and examine it. Even with his hands a fair distance from the object, it cast enough heat to blister his skin. He, who believed in neither signs nor death, who, truth be told, believed in nothing at all, stared down for a long time, no bloody idea what to make of it. On the opposite side of the fallen star, etched by a quill of stardust, three words gleamed. I'm okay. I'm... Earth dust. The soul stealer had no idea how long it slumbered. It didn't know it was slumbering. It thought it had died. Strains of music shivered into the earth, burrowed deep into fertile soil, through rock, clay, and rock again, sinking deeper into iron, lead, copper, silver, and gold, then an alien, immutable alloy until at last the ancient melody penetrated the tomb and nudged the deadly Leviathan awake. Awareness dawned in slow stages. It remembered then. The arrival of the fairy, the endless, unwinnable war, the lies and deception, the loss of power, the torture, the conquest, the brutalized face, the mask, the incarceration, the disease that claimed it, until finally it was a shade among shadows. Mask clattering to age-old stone, it had become as insubstantial as air. At the end, with the last vestige of its awareness, it managed no more than a feeble protest. It had once believed itself obdurate, eternal, unstoppable. It would make certain of that this time.
1. The pupil in denial. I can't take my eyes off you.
I smell bones!
Shazam exploded, whiskers bristling with excitement.
Bones everywhere! Thousands and thousands of them! You take me to all the best places, Yee-Yee!
He slanted me an adoring look before launching himself at the earth and digging, sending tufts of grass and dirt flying. Stop digging, I exclaimed. You can't eat those bones.
Kanzu, what?
Came the muffled voice. No, I mean, you're not allowed to eat them, I clarified. He ignored me. Dirt continued to fly, mounting rapidly behind him. Shazam, I mean it. You promised to obey my rules. "My expects," I reminded, using his often stilted manner of speaking. "Bars on your cage." Head buried in the dirt, he said in a muffled voice,
"That was then. This is now. Then I didn't have a home."
"Shazam," I said, in the warning tone I knew he hated, but heeded. Pudgy body wedged halfway into his hole. My hillcat stiffened and inched out, exceedingly slowly and begrudgingly, and glared at me. Dirt dusted his broad nose, his silver whiskers, and clung to his long silver smoke ruff. He sneezed violently, licked his nose, then scrubbed it with a furious paw.
"But they're bones, tiny red. They're already dead. I'm not killing them. You said I couldn't kill anything. You didn't say I couldn't eat things that were dead."
His eyes narrowed to violet slits.
"You buffleskate your expects. You buffleskate my head. Who even does that?"
Buffleskate wasn't a word I knew. He had many of those. But I intuited the meaning. "These bones are different. They matter to humans. We bury them in certain places for a reason." He spoke slowly and carefully, as if addressing a complete idiot.
"Me, too. So they're easy to find when I'm hungry."
I shook my head, a smile tugging at my lips. "No, these are the bones of people we care about." I gestured at the dark silhouettes of gravestones that stretched for acres around us. "We don't eat them. We bury them, so..."
"But nobody's doing things with them, and they're rotting,"
he wailed. Slumping on his haunches, he splayed his front paws around his pudgy white belly.
"You give bones, I find bones. Same thing. One good reason why I can't eat them,"
he demanded. I debated trying to explain human burial rituals to him, but many of our traditions defied his comprehension. A bone was a bone was a bone. Convincing him that graveyard bones carried an emotional and spiritual attachment to humans, unlike the cow or pig bones I sometimes brought him, could take all night, and leave him just as bewildered as he'd begun, and me exhausted. I gave him the only answer that worked at a time like this, the answer I'd hated as a kid. "Because I said so." He rose to his full height, arched his back and hissed at me, bearing sharp fangs and a long black-tipped tongue. I returned his snarl. With Shazam, I didn't dare yield, or say, "just one bone, just this time," because in his mind, if a rule could be violated once, it was no longer a rule, and never would be again. Unless, of course, it worked in his favor. His eyes turned flinty. Mine cooled to emerald ice. He cut me a look of scathing rebuke. I switched tactics and flayed him with an expression of reproach and disappointment. His violet eyes widened as if I'd struck him. He shuddered dramatically, toppled over, collapsed on his back, and began to weep with great hiccuping sobs, clutching his paws to his eyes. I sighed. This was my best friend, the last remaining Hellcat in existence. Powerful, often brilliant beyond comprehension, most of the time he was a wildly emotional hot mess. I adored him. Sometimes when he flashed like wildfire between feral and neurotic, feeling every facet of his life so intensely, I saw myself as a kid, too much to handle. I'd been kept in a cage for most of my childhood. I didn't own a cage and never would. I moved across the damp grass, sank down beside the sobbing, shaggy-pelted chimera with traits of an Iberian lynx and the supple, lazy posture of a koala bear, and tugged the 50-pound beast toward me. The moment I touched him, he howled bloody murder and began to growl, then made himself stiff, unwieldy, and mysteriously heavier. With all four legs sticking straight up in the air, sharp black claws extended, spine rigid, hoisting a hostile hyena onto my lap might have been easier. He stopped growling long enough to snap,
"Don't touch me! Find your own dimension! You're cramping my space!"
Then he collapsed across my legs and his head lolled back.
"Comb my neck! It's tangled again!"
he wailed. I bit my lip to keep from laughing. Shazam got his feelings hurt easily in this state. Using my nails, I groomed the thick pelt of his chin, his shaggy neck, and around behind his ears until I heard a deep, contented rumble in his chest. We sprawled in the grass in the graveyard behind Arlington Abbey, beneath a cobalt sky glittering with rose-gold stars and a full amber moon, enjoying the moment. It was the middle of March, but fat-blossomed velvety poppies bobbed in nearby urns, and exotic trellis roses adorned graves, scenting the night air with indefinable fey fragrances. A night symphony of crickets and frogs filled the air. Dublin's climate had been uncharacteristically mild since the Queen of the Fae used the Song of Making to heal our world last November. We'd had no winter. A long, fertile spring had morphed seamlessly into an extraordinary summer, splashed with brilliant fae colours and new species of plants. There'd been little peace in my life. I tended to find myself embroiled in one melodrama after the next, but aside from a broken heart that wasn't healing on the timetable I would have preferred, life was good. I had Shazam, I had friends, I would heal, and there was endless potential for new adventures once I did. Eventually, the Hellcat squinted a lavender eye open and peered up at me. I caught my breath. There was nothing feral or neurotic in his gaze now, only an ancient wisdom wed to remote, timeless as the stars' patience. I'd learned to listen carefully when he looked at me like this.
Remains of the one who danced you into love are in the ground, Yi-Yi. That's why you don't want me to eat the bones. Do what you came for. I will hunt only the tasty night moths.
Smirking, he added.
And I will kill as you do, with love.
He surged from my lap in a suspiciously graceful leap, given the heft of his body, and bounded into the darkness beyond the graves. I rolled my eyes as he vanished. I'd been trained to kill at the age of 9. Before then, I'd killed without training. Shortly after I rescued Shazam from Planet X, he asked how my killing was different from the killing I'd forbidden him to do, aside from me wasting food by not eating my prey. I told him that when I killed, it wasn't with the hatred that once blazed in my heart, but with love for the world I was trying to protect. I did it only when necessary, as quickly and mercifully as possible. Killing with violence in your heart, or worse, a complete dearth of emotion, made you a killer, plain and simple. Killing because it had to be done, because there was no other way and it was the right thing to do, made you a necessary weapon. Do what you came here for. I wasn't sure what that was. Nothing of Dancer remained in this macabre memorial to the dead behind Arlington Abbey. I found that a terrible thought, that his essence might be trapped in a box buried beneath the dirt. When I die, cremate me and cast me to the stars. Still, I pushed to my feet, skirted a bank of low hedges and wide planters, and moved to stand at the foot of his grave. Time slid away. It was 4 months ago, and I was kissing Dancer's cold lips and closing the lid of his casket. God, I missed him. We'd played with the innocence and impunity of kids who believed themselves immortal. At least I had. Conquering video games, watching movies, dreaming together about what our futures might hold, gorging on ice cream and candy and sodas, racing out into the night in search of adventure. I smiled faintly. We'd found plenty. We'd plunged into life with similar enthusiasm and devil-may-care bravado. Caring, thoughtful and brilliant, he'd been one of the only two people I've ever met that I thought was as smart, possibly smarter, than me. We'd grown up, become lovers. Dancer Elias Garrick, never the sidekick, always the hero. I shoved my hands into my pockets and stared down. I'm not a woman who often looks back. I measure actions by results, and peering into the past rarely yields any. Reflecting on something that hurts you only prolongs your pain. And when death is involved, the pain is often compounded by a relentless sense of guilt that attacks the moment you start to heal, as if duration of grief somehow proves the depth of your love for the person you lost. If that were true, I'd have to grieve Dancer forever. Born with a flawed heart, he'd lived fearlessly. The unfairly penalized muscle in his chest had given out on him before he'd turned 18, while I was sleeping next to him in bed. I'd woken after a night of lovemaking to find him forever gone. I'd melted down. It got ugly. My friends got me through it. Guilt had definitely led me here, but not spawned by lack of grief. A sheer abundance of it made me do something stupid last night. I tried to erase my pain in another man's bed. It had seemed like a good idea at the time. It hadn't worked. The first man I'd had sex with taught me how beautiful it was. The second man had shown me how ugly it could be. "I miss you," I whispered to his grave, and waited. Shortly after he died, he spoke to me twice. I felt his presence, as if he was standing right there behind me, sunshine on my shoulders, reaching through the slipstream to comfort and counsel me. A few weeks ago, however, I'd become aware that intangible warmth was gone, vanished while I slept, and I knew in my gut he'd moved on. Somehow, he'd managed to linger in the ether to make sure I was all right, and when he was satisfied, he'd raced off for the next grand adventure. As he should have. As we all should, when it's our time. That thought didn't make me feel any better. Thoughts rarely do. The heart has its own mind, measures its own time, and if it consults with the brain, doesn't always heed the advice. My brain was screaming, "Stop hurting already!" to a deaf audience. I'd never fully grasped the meaning of the word forever before. I'd lost my mom long before she died. It wasn't the same. I grieved her while she'd still been living. But the idea that I would never see Dancer again was more than I could stand. All I had left of him were memories, and we'd not had time to make nearly enough. My gaze drifted to the headstone east of his marker. Joe Brennan. We'd laid another of my friends to rest beside him. I smiled faintly, remembering her breaking into my dungeon cell to save me. We hadn't always gotten along, but she'd been a genuine good constant in my life and didn't deserve to die the way she did. Alina McKenna Lane. Mac's sister was buried beside her. There'd been so much death in my life.
All the more reason to live by.
Came the deep, exotically accented growl from behind me. I could hear traces of many languages in it, a consensus of none. I bristled. Not many people can sneak up on me without my preternatural senses kicking into high alert. Raiden defies the odds in countless, irritating ways. Stay out of my head.
I wasn't in it. Didn't need to be. When humans stand at graves, they brood.
He was beside me then, in that sudden, silent, eerie way of his. Humans, he'd said. Whatever Raiden was, he wasn't one of those, and he'd stopped making any effort to conceal it from me. Whether urbane, sophisticated man, or black-skinned, fanged beast, he was all the supers I was, plus an awe-inspiring, aggravating assortment of others. When I was young, I'd felt like Sarah from the movie Labyrinth, dashing around Dublin, having grand adventures. Riordan was Jareth, my goblin king. I'd defied him at every turn, defining myself in opposition to him. I'd studied him, incorporating his ideologies and tactics into my own. Silverside, I'd functioned by the code WWRD. I'd never tell him that. I turned and scowled up at him. Beautiful, cool, aloof man. Two things always happen to me whenever he shows up. I get an instant jolt of happiness, as if every cell in my body wakes up and is glad to see him. It pisses me off, because my brain rarely agrees. Raiden and I are enthusiastic foes, wary friends. I tell him things I don't tell anyone else, and that offends me too. The second thing baffles me. I often feel like crying. I've wept on his flawless, crisp shirts more times than I care to remember.
"Because I understand,"
he murmured, staring down at me with those glittering silver eyes.
And I can take it. I wasn't sure about the happiness, though. Nice of you to clear that up.
What part of stay out of my head didn't you understand?
Your face, Denny. Everything you feel is on it. I rarely need to delve deeper.
He'd glimpsed such raw emotion in me recently that I'd been avoiding him. As Jada, I was respected, feared. As Danny, I sometimes felt like I vied with Shazam for Hot Mess Poster Child of the Month. I could only hope what happened last night was nowhere to be seen on my face. I'd never before experienced what an average woman with average strength contended with on a daily basis. Physical vulnerability to the opposite sex. It had been humbling and horrifying, and awakened a fierce compassion in me, making me even more protective of my city, especially women and children. In bed with a stranger, my heart felt like it was going to explode. I'd tried to leave the man and that empty thing I was doing, but the intensity of my emotions shorted out my she-seer strength, leaving me a frighteningly normal 5'10" woman who weighed in at 142 in a locked room with a 6'4", 240-pound man, who'd called me a cock-tease and turned violent. I hadn't killed him. I'd wanted to. If he'd succeeded in raping me, I'm not sure what I would have done. No is no, no matter when it's said. As it was, I'd be watching him from a distance to make sure he never crossed that line again. And if he did, well, violate others' liberties, lose your own.
Ah, Denny.
Riordan touched my cheek, brushing a stray curl back and tucking it behind my ear.
Men can be bloody bastards, but not all of them. Don't let it shut you down. Be fearless. Don't be afraid to fall. Taste it all.
My eyes flashed mutinously, not because of what he'd said, but rather what he hadn't said. It was there in his voice. Mac and Barons left 2 weeks ago to deal with the revolt happening in Faerie. She'd reminded me time moved differently there. A week for her might be as much as a year for me. He was leaving too. That sounds suspiciously like goodbye. He smiled, but it didn't reach his eyes. There was a palpable coolness, a distance in Riordan's gaze most of the time. A thousand-yard stare that's seen and done things that change you forever. A big-picture view. I understand it. I see the same look in my own eyes sometimes.
There's something I have to do.
I knew it. I said coolly, great, me and Shazam will come with you.
You can't.
Sure we can. They've elected a council for the Abbey, gone back to popular vote like old times. I'm merely a consultant. I wanted it that way. Freedom to come and go as I pleased.
Not this time.
You just told me to taste it all. I'm merely taking your...
Nothing. You're taking nothing.
He cut me off harshly.
I can't take you with me now. You don't belong with me now.
Gone was the polished, sophisticated man. The black-skinned beast he sometimes became stared out at me through cold, incalculably ancient eyes, flecks of crimson glittering in their depths. The beast's atavistic presence reshaped the planes and angles of his face, changing and elongating his jaws to accommodate the sudden appearance of fangs. Once I'd kissed him, felt those fangs graze my teeth as pure high voltage had arced between us. Once I'd offered him my virginity. He'd rejected me, and I'd vowed he'd never get another chance. His gaze shuddered, and he was Riordan again. A man with even white teeth and the clearest gaze I'd ever seen. A man who played the long game and suffered no conflicts being what he was. Ruthless. A prick. My friend.
Remember the cell phone and the tattoo,
he said.
It doesn't matter if the cell towers are up or not. IISS will always work. Use it only if you must.
IISS, code for I'm in serious shit, was a number programmed into my phone that would activate the spelled tattoo Riordan had inked at the base of my spine at my request. According to him, he could find me anywhere, virtually instantly. I know the rules, only if I'm dying. He was leaving. This was really goodbye. My hodgepodge family pieced together of extraordinary friends was falling apart. I took comfort in knowing he was near, in my city, and I could see him any time I chose. Not that I had lately, but I liked knowing the Imperious King was holding court eternal in his glass kingdom high above the rest of us, that Chester's nightclub was open and it was business as usual. I may not have gone inside over the past few months, but I'd certainly made a point of passing it frequently. I keep an eye on the things that matter to me. My heart chilled, and I let it. Dancer, Joe, Mac, Barons, now Riordan.
Don't do that,
he growled. Don't tell me what to do, I growled back. You're leaving. You don't have a say anymore.
I always have a say. I don't need your permission.
I clipped. Clearly. He was leaving Dublin without it. Did he think I would beg him to stay? Never. People had to want to stay, choose to be with you, or it meant nothing. There were physical cages, and there were emotional ones. Holding on to someone too tightly made it hard for them to breathe, and eventually, inevitably, they'd do one of two things. Suffocate or run, leaving you feeling like hell either way. I waved a dismissive hand. What are you waiting for then? Go. His nostrils flared, and a muscle twitched in his cheek. Moonlight silvered a face I'd once thought uncaring and remote. I'd traced the sharpness of those cheekbones with my fingers, the shadow beard of his jaw, the scar that bisected the thick column of his neck. I'd experienced the rare emotional ferocity of the man. He made me uneasy in ways I didn't understand. I sighed and said, in spite of myself, "When are you coming back?"
It'll be a while.
Be precise. Weeks? A month or two? When he didn't answer, I gaped, incredulous. Years? Are you kidding me? His eyes narrowed, and he spat in a savage rush.
Listen to me and carve everything I'm about to say into that giant, complicated brain of yours. You're right about killing with love. Keep the light shining in your heart. Death is a hungry darkness. It wants to swallow us. You're different, and will always be misunderstood. Never let that touch you. You're a terribly real thing in a terribly false world. The world is fucked up, not you. Stay close to Shazam. You need each other. Don't return to Dancer's grave again. He's not here, and you know it. If he could see you now, standing at his grave, he'd kick your ass right out of this cemetery and ask if you'd lost your bloody mind. You don't grieve love. You celebrate that you had it. Choose the men you take to your bed by these criteria. They see the finest in you, enhance and defend it. When you fuck a man, you are giving him a motherfucking gift. Be certain he deserves it. And bloody hell, don't have one-night stands. Commit to the action. Make it matter. Feel it and ride it all the way through.
I fixated on his final words with aggrieved incredulity. Says the king of the infamous nod and one-night stands. I'd had no intention of having sex last night. I hadn't even vaguely entertained the notion. But my heart hurt so damned much. And the man standing next to me in the pub was good-looking and flirtatious. And I'd needed desperately to dump some of my emotion. I thought it might make me feel better. Perhaps even refueled, like hugging. I thought I might pour out some of my pain through my hands, dump it on another man's body, get up, walk away clearer, more grounded.
Never dump emotion, Danny. Channel it. Find an equal that can handle it. But don't waste that precious commodity.
Is Lore going too? I demanded. What about the others? He made no reply, but I didn't need one. I could see it in his eyes. They were all leaving, or had already gone. I had no idea where or why. But one thing was clear. I wasn't invited. "Who's going to run Chester's?" I said, as if that alone might make him stay. Constructed of chrome and glass, and a mysterious alloy Dancer and I had never been able to identify, Chester's Above was the hottest nightclub in Dublin, offering dozens of sub-clubs that catered to all types of clientele, while below was the Nine's Kingdom, containing their private residences and clubs. Level after level stretched for miles beneath the ground, powered by a vast geothermal array that, knowing Riordan, probably tapped the magma itself. Suspended above the club was Riordan's see-through glass office, equipped with the latest electronic surveillance devices, serving as the lofty throne from which he surveyed his world. I had no idea how long they'd lived there, but I suspected it was a very, very long time.
"It's been closed. Stay out of it."
Chester's was dark. I'd only ever seen it that way a few times, and I'd hated it, like a carnival packed up to quit town, leaving behind only a muddy field of tattered flyers and tarnished dreams. "I'll bloody well go wherever I want. Once you're gone, it's not yours anymore. Maybe I'll take it over, recreate it as my own club." But I wouldn't. I'd have to kill half his patrons. Riordan was an equal opportunity host, catering to the best and worst of men and monsters. However, I certainly wasn't averse to poking around after he'd gone, to see if he'd left anything interesting lying around.
"I said stay out. And don't worry, you'll be protected. I've taken precautions."
Protected my ass? I didn't need protecting, nor did I want it. I wanted my family. I wanted him to stay in Chester's, where he belonged, so he'd be there in case I decided I wanted to see him. I resisted the urge to fist my hands. He'd notice. He'd draw conclusions. The man didn't miss a thing. "When have I ever needed protecting?" He snorted.
"As if keeping you alive hasn't been a bloody full-time job."
Once Riordan made up his mind, nothing changed it. There was only one thing to do. Tell him goodbye and wish him well, while making it clear I didn't need him and wouldn't miss him. I opened my mouth and said, "I hate you." He threw his head back and laughed, stymieing me. Who laughs when you tell them you hate them? Then his hands were in my hair and his lips were against mine. Soft, easy. Neither provocation nor invitation, but instant. Electrifying current arced between us, the same as it had the last time we'd kissed, as well as the first time, when I'd meant it mostly to mess with him. It had messed with us both. I leaned into him. It would have been wiser to go to him to dump emotion last night. Safer, at least in body. His hands tightened on my scalp, and he said with sudden fury,
"I wouldn't have let you. Don't come to me like that, Danny. Never fucking come to me like that."
That was the last straw. The final blade-sharp words I would let him cut me with. Our kisses had taken on a grim pattern. We shared one, we insulted each other, we stalked away. "Fuck you too, Riordan." But he was gone, already halfway across the cemetery, slipping between gravestones and trees. He was leaving. For years. And I didn't even know how many. It hurt me in places I didn't know I could hurt. If he'd been trying to get my mind off Dancer, he'd succeeded. There was nothing like a fresh, unexpected wound to make the pain of the older one feel slightly less crippling. I narrowed my eyes, trying to separate him from the night, determined to watch him until the very last second, until he was finally, fully beyond my vision, beyond my reach. It wasn't easy. Riordan in his natural state is a shadow among shadows. A subtlety of darkness. A whisper of power. A ripple of grace. Immortal. So damned strong. Unbreakable. I wanted to be him. I wanted to run with him. I wanted to run away from him and never look back. Just before I lost sight of him, I thought I heard him murmur,
"Until the day you're willing to stay."
2. My blood types Krylon, Technicolor, Type A. I wandered the cemetery, keeping an eye out for Shazam, without calling for him in case he was hunting dinner. We'd agreed that he could eat like any wild creature, taking a single kill a night, as long as it was something he could catch and devour in his current form. No turning into the genocidal version of himself capable of devouring civilizations. Despite his sentience and ability to talk, he was still a hot-blooded beast that relished the hunt. I understood that. Besides, I'd reasoned, it was possible the exercise might slim him down. Although I loved every inch of his cuddly girth, being awakened in the morning by a 50-pound pounce on a full bladder was brutal. Not, however, as brutal as Riordan and the rest of the nine packing up and leaving Dublin. My city was starting to feel like a ghost town, despite the hordes of people emigrating from all over the world. There weren't many cities as fully functional as ours. People came drawn by our technology, supplies, and the relative safety and order we'd managed to achieve. Years ago, before I got lost Silverside and ended up with no idea how old I am, which is somewhere between 19 and 21, my world was pretty much perfect for a short spell. Well, before Mac found out I was the assassin who killed her sister, then things got a bit dicey. Point is, I'd had a small group of people I thought of as mine. Some of them I'd liked better than others, depending on the day of the week, but after our last adventure together saving the world, my group of sharp-edged, brilliant, deeply committed friends had become my family. Now, most of them were gone. I still had Kat, Enyo, and the She-Seers, and I thought I still had Christian McKelter, although I hadn't seen him in a while. But Mac, Barons, Riordan, and Lore, they were like me. Powerful, strong, invested in doing their best to understand their ever-changing place in an ever-changing world. Though I was reluctant to admit it, each of them was, in their own way, a role model of sorts. A challenge I'd relish to get stronger, smarter, faster, better. "I can't believe they even trust me by myself," I muttered. There was a time they wouldn't have. I shouldn't be left alone and unsupervised. They know that. But trying to make light of things to conceal my true feelings no longer worked as well as it once had. So I did what I always do if I can't change anything about what's bothering me. Partition off a quiet place in my mind and tuck it away. Don't pick at it. Go on with life. Time had a funny way of teasing out the most complicated knots. While part of me wanted to mull over the things Riordan had said, particularly what I'd thought I heard him say at the last, I refused to indulge myself. Assuming I drew any conclusions, what good would it do? He was gone. For years. I refused to allow the bastard to consume my brain in his absence. He'd like that. Ergo, open box, shove in, close box. When he returned, I'd open the box again. Dancer, however, I left rattling around in my head. He hadn't left by choice. I would work through the grief. It would change me, but I knew I'd like the woman I'd be by the time I was through. And Dancer would too. Meanwhile, I needed a mystery to take my mind off things. Finding one in Dublin, AWC, after the wall crash, and ATS, after the song, should be as simple as heading back to the city. Shazam would catch up with me as soon as he'd eaten. He can find me anywhere. So I glanced up to set my bearings by the stars. After wasting so many years staring at a TV from behind bars, I spent a lot of time looking up now. I'm obsessed with the sky, especially at night. It has a way of making me feel utterly irrelevant, while part of a vast, timeless whole. I'll never forget my first week free of the cage. At night, I slept on the ground in the middle of wide-open fields, drifting off with my arms behind my head, marveling at the immensity of it all. A child, whose entire universe had, until then, been 42 square feet. Position noted, I hurried to the drive to circumvent gravestones before kicking up into the slipstream. During that perilous first instant or two, before I enter the higher dimension in which I've learned to move, I can still crash into things. Once I'm up, I'm flawless. Coming down is even trickier than going up, and how I get most of my bruises. I paused on the pavement, glanced around to lock down the many variables on my mental grid, and froze, a chill of horror licking up my spine. Not many things do that to me. What the... I bit off the hushed curse, and went as still as one of the corpses in the ground, adjusting my breath to minute, shallow inhales. I'm not here. I'm not here, I willed. What I was seeing was impossible. The Song of Making had been sung. The Unseelie had been destroyed by it, all of them. I no longer carried flashlights or a Mac-Halo. The life-sucking shades were gone. Nonetheless, I was surrounded by them, hemmed in by countless inky shadows rising from the earth, bursting from graves, exploding from headstones, ghosting out windows of crumbling mausoleums, even clawing their ghastly passage through pavement. Dozens, no, 100 or more filled the cemetery. One fought its way free of the blacktop 5 feet from my left. Another hovered a few feet in front of me. There were three of the lethal things to my right. I didn't dare glance behind me, because they hadn't seemed to notice me yet. Perhaps they'd gorge on grass, flowers and trees and move on, sated, if I held very, very still. I locked down my limbs, but my mind raced. It had been nearly 4 months since the new Queen of the Fae sang the exquisite, dangerous melody that repaired the rifts in the fabric of our world. It was common knowledge that nothing Unseelie could survive that song, and nothing Unseelie had been seen since. I've always been massively suspicious of common knowledge, clearly with good reason. The cemetery was packed with shades, nearly as many as had broken free of the poisoned Dejai orb on Halloween, when the wall between the worlds of Fae and Man had been destroyed. How did they survive the song? What else had survived it? Amorphous vampires, shades live in the darkness and suck the life from anything or anyone foolish enough to stumble across their path. Not that I'd been doing any stumbling, nor had I been foolish in thinking I no longer needed a bloody Mac-Halo. I had every reason to toss my bike helmet adorned with dozens of LED lights onto a shelf. The Unseelie were dead. Not. When shades dine on humans, they leave behind small sundaes of papery husks, garnished with shiny fillings, watches, implants, and other oddities. They suck even the sap and insects from trees, strip the soil so clean not a speck of bacteria remains. My sword is useless against them. All weapons are. Shades can't be killed, and the only thing that can save you from a gruesome death is light. If you have enough, you can hold them at bay. My cell phone wouldn't cast enough light to protect even one of my hands. Take that, Riordan. You leave, I die. May you be crushed by a mountain of guilt. I slammed the lid of that box back down. The shades were moving, swarming, drifting near, slithering away. The cloud of darkness directly in front of me listed nearer and hovered 10 inches from my left boot. No way I could try to kick up into the slipstream. It was too close. I'd collide with it before escaping to the higher dimension. If I'd been High Fae, I could have sifted. But freeze-framing, what I do, is clumsier, slower, and not nearly as elegant. Fae can blink out and reappear half a world away. I'm far more limited. There was no way I was calling for Shazam. I wouldn't put him in danger. I wasn't sure how powerful he was against something like this, and losing him would positively gut me. My cell phone was in my back pocket. I calculated the odds of getting it out, pressing it on, and managing to thumb up IISS before the nearest shade devoured my foot. Not good. I went for it anyway. Some folks suffer a delusion that life is about making the right choices,
implying there is a right choice in every situation. I don't know what kind of life they live, but in mine, the only course of action is often a bad one. I die doing something or I die doing nothing. Although I loathed calling Riordan for help, I loathed the idea of dying more. And I deeply despised that I hadn't been able to manage life on my own for an entire 10 minutes after he'd gone. My hand cleared my side, slid beneath my sword, and plunged into my back pocket. The shade swallowed my left boot. I gaped down in horror as I fumbled my phone from my pocket and thumbed up the contacts, furious at the epic waste the tattoo Riordan inked on my skin had already proven to be. Who had time to search through their phone contacts when they were being attacked by shades? The shade swallowed my left knee. There went my right knee. I'd vanished from mid-thigh down. Even if I were able to dial IISS now, and I couldn't because I had a lot of numbers in my cell phone and couldn't find the bloody thing, even if he arrived instantly and somehow managed to do the unthinkable and kill it, my legs were already gone. I wasted a fraction of a second wondering whether I wanted to live without legs. There it was. IISS. My thumb paused slightly above it. Refused to move. I could feel my legs. They were icy, but there. I peered down. The shade was motionless, an inky, oily sleeve around my lower body. I frowned. This wasn't how shades behaved. When Sorcha, a fellow She-Seer, died, Claire had seen it happen, and said Sorcha vanished into her own boot as she pulled it on, thanks to a shade tucked in the darkness within. This particular caste of Unseelie devoured their prey instantly, and with one swift inhalation, then belched a small pile of crumbs. Or, in her case, left them in her shoe. Was it possible it wasn't a shade? If so, what was it? I realized, with a distant part of my brain, that my legs weren't the only part of me that was cold. My left hand was freezing and itching. I glanced at it. It was completely black, with dark veins crisscrossing my pale wrist. It was the hand I'd used to stab the hunter with years ago when something of the ancient beast seemed to slither up my sword, infecting me. The shade was on the move again, inching upward. I had no idea what might happen, if anything at all, but I sliced my cold black hand down into the inky cloud as if it were a blade. The shade recoiled violently and reared away. It stopped a dozen or so feet from me and hung suspended in the air. I was struck by the sudden certainty that it was assessing me. I could feel a sentient mind taking my measure, evaluating me, determining what to do next. I glanced around. All the shade-like things in the cemetery had gone still, and I deduced, from the slight lean of their amorphous forms, that they were peering at my attacker, as if listening. What the bloody hell was this? A collective swarm of evolved shades? The thought was terrifying. The cell phone was still in my hand, the screen lit, waiting for me to press IISS. I thumbed it off. I was not calling for help. He'd left me on my own. I'd handle it myself. Get out of here, I roared, lunging for whatever it was. The shadowy shape recoiled again, vanishing on a sudden gust of wind, then re-solidifying in the same spot. More breezed over to join it, settling on either side, until I stood glaring at a nearly solid wall of blackness 50 feet wide. I gestured threateningly with my left hand. I'll destroy you. You picked the wrong woman to mess with on the wrong bloody night. I was already in a bad enough mood, I snarled. I paused and did that thing I used to do when I was young, when I was still killing with hate in my heart. Enough to Kevlar all the Garda in Dublin. I embraced my rage at the injustice and hypocrisy of the world, welcomed it, let it fill my body, shape my limbs, backlight my eyes. I knew what I looked like when I let it happen. Riordan on his worst day. There was steel in my spine and death in my eyes when I swaggered toward the menacing wall. You have 2 choices, I said in a terrible voice, my left hand raised high. Leave or die. The wall vanished. I blinked, murmuring, well, mildly surprised and majorly skeptical. I knew I could be intimidating, but I was a single person, and there were hundreds of them. I stood for several long moments, scanning the cemetery, unwilling to act rashly from a misguided belief they were gone. The monsters that stalk our world are devious, patient, and sly. So are a lot of the humans. While I waited, I evened out my breath. It was a constant reminder of how I lived. Bold, ruthless, energy, action, tenacity, hunger. B-R-E-A-T-H. I wanted to kick up into the slipstream and rush to the nearest pool of light. But I don't run from the things I fear anymore. They chase you, gaining substance and power the longer you run. When several minutes passed without any of the shadows reappearing, I shoved the cell phone back in my pocket and turned to walk through the cemetery, eyes peeled for clues. I stumbled smack into a gravestone, tripped over it, rolled, sprang up, and stood motionless, running a rapid internal assessment. I felt oddly shaky, weak, as if my legs might go out from under me if I moved suddenly. Brushes with death usually invigorate me, but this one had rattled me more than I'd realized. On the off chance I was simply hungry, a far more palatable conclusion to both tongue and ego, I crammed a protein bar in my mouth and resumed walking, taking careful mental notes about the locations from which the unknown entities had come, their shapes and sizes, their actions, and filed it all neatly away in my mental vaults. I'd wanted a distraction. I'd certainly gotten one. A mystery, wrapped in an enigma, topped with a bow of suspense and danger. I was whistling a cheery tune by the time Shazam bounded out of the night to join me. Blood on his furry muzzle, delight in his violet eyes. We moved together, and I rested my hand on his shaggy head as we padded into the night. Still, I made a mental note to be a bit more careful about the things I asked the universe for in the future. Now, all men have limits. They learn what they are and learn not to exceed them. I ignore mine. Batman. Great spirits have long suffered violent opposition from mediocre minds. Einstein. What they said. Danny O'Malley, still as mega as ever. 3. The roads are fragile food for city crooks on a starry night. Dublin. 2 years, 5 months, ATS.
Another 3 of them, Danny?
Rainy Lane exclaimed as she threw open the door of the townhouse. The light from the cozily furnished home spilled into the night, glistening on cobblestones damp from a recent rain. Backlit, the 54-year-old woman looked like the radiant, matronly angel of mercy she'd proven to be since I brought the first of the orphans to her. 4, I corrected, motioning to the eldest of the children huddled behind me. Her name was Sarah Brady, she'd told me grudgingly, and she was 11 years old. Her brother Thomas was 7. The girl holding his hand was 5, and the baby, a mere 10 months. As I reached behind Sarah to unfasten the satchel that held her sleeping sister, she tensed, rising to the balls of her feet and knocked my arm away, thin shoulders trembling. Poised to run, her eyes darted nervously as she considered her odds. The chilly, dangerous night, or the warm, inviting light. "You agreed to come here with me," I reminded. "You'll be safe and well cared for."
"How long have they been on their own?"
Rainy asked quietly. "Nearly 2 months. Like most, they've no idea what happened to their parents."
"I do. The fairy took them," the boy blurted. "I saw it, I did, with my own."
Sarah's mouth thinned to a line as she kicked him sharply in the shins.
"Hush, Thomas. You're not to be speaking of that."
The boy began to cry, tears trickling down grimy cheeks. He rubbed his eyes with his fists, then shook one at her.
"But it's true, I thought. It was one of the fairy. You know it's true, Sarah, you..."
When she kicked him again harder, I moved between them and drew one to each side, resting my hands on their thin, knobby shoulders. "You'll be safe here. This is Rainy Lane. She helps run the foster center."
"Where they'll split us up," Sarah hissed, pulling away from me.
Rainy spoke swiftly. "We never separate siblings. If we're unable to find a good home for the four of you, you may stay in the center as long as you like." That was one of the things I'd been counting on when I brought Rainy the first of the abandoned children I discovered, half dead in the streets. Her adopted daughters were biological sisters, Alina and Michaela Lane. Family was everything to her. Still, it wouldn't be long before the recently formed center became too full to continue offering such an alternative. Sarah Brady squinted up at Rainy through damp, tangled hair, hostility blazing in her eyes. Silently, I applauded her bravado. The terrified 11-year-old had managed to take care of her infant sister and her younger siblings for nearly 2 months, without the many she-seer gifts I'd had at her age. She was a fighter. But she was an 80-pound, dripping-wet fighter, and Dublin, AWC, was no city for lightweights. "You know who I am and what I do," I said to Sarah softly. "Have you heard such terrible things about me then? Or the foster center?"
"I've not heard of your foster center at all," she said stiffly. "But kids on the telly always get split up."
"And dreadful things happen to them," the shadows in her eyes said.
"What about me?" I said. "What about you?" Sarah said with a dismissive sniff.
I smiled faintly. She knew who I was. I was a legend. My talents, coupled with the infrequent appearance of Shazam, had seen to that.
"You're some kind of superhero," the boy exclaimed. "And your sword?"
He gestured to it where it was sheathed across my back.
"Crashes like lightning when you fight. And you have a great fat cat with superpowers."
I winked at Thomas.
"Never call him fat. It makes him grumpy. Nor is he, quite a cat."
Well, he was a hell cat, but that was an entirely different thing.
"There's no such thing as superheroes," Sarah scoffed. "And if you are one, why didn't you stop the fairy?"
She clamped her mouth shut. These weren't the first children I'd found who believed the Fae had stolen their parents. It made no sense. Fae didn't abduct adults. They lured them off with glamour, illusion, and lies. "Where else will you sleep tonight? They firebombed your squat and burned you out," I reminded. "For no reason. In a moment of boredom. A diversion for the three bullies who'd done it." They'd laughed as the children fled the blazing shell, screaming. Sent three half-starved kids and a helpless baby out into the deadly night. I'd been torn between going after the kids or the bastards who'd tossed the bombs. I'd gone for the kids. First. Sarah fisted her hands at her sides.
"It wasn't fair. I found that house. No one else was living there. I watched it for 5 days before we took it, and they burnt it. A perfectly good place to live. They didn't even want it. Why would anyone do that?"
A house with running water and electricity. A thing she'd needed desperately to keep her family alive. But possession was 9/10 of the law only if one was strong enough to enforce that law, and her ragged troop wasn't. During the day, Dublin AWC was a normal, bustling, safe city, if there was such a thing, with the walls down between Fae and mortals, 2/3 of the world population gone, fragments of fairy drifting free, light court Fae living openly in town, establishing cult-like settlements around the country, and gangs warring to control supply and demand. At night, all bets were off. The predators came out to play, and if you weren't one of them, you were meat. There were only 3 types of beings that dared trespass beyond the protected Temple Bar district after dark. The very powerful, the very foolish, or the helpless, driven there by one threat or another.
"Just stay here with me for the night," Rainy said gently. "See how you feel in the morning. No one will force you to remain with us.
May I see the baby, Sarah? She extended her arms. I believe we've a diaper that needs changing. Sarah shot a quick glance over her shoulder and sniffed, then glared up at Rainey. I suppose you've no diapers? Rainey went on in a low, soothing tone. No food or change of clothing. We've plenty of that here. Of course Sarah had nothing, I thought with a rush of bitterness and relief. She hadn't been on the streets long enough to realize a child on her own needed many, many places to hide. All that she'd managed to beg, borrow, or steal was stashed in the house that was taken from her. It was time for tough love. I said, Do you want your baby sister to get diaper rash or catch cold from the weather? How will you get medicine if one of you gets sick? You might be able to survive out there, Sarah, but the others won't. What if something happens to you? What will your sisters and brother do then? You're responsible for them. You have to be strong enough for four. Now isn't the time to be short-sighted and selfish. Sarah flinched and cried. I'm not selfish. Fear, isolation, crushing responsibility, she woke up to it, lived it all day, and fell asleep with it. A too heavy stone in her too empty stomach. I wanted to hug her, take her in my arms and promise her life would be good again. Not selfish at all. Selflessly doing everything she could. But I needed to get her inside the door of the townhouse. There were three bastards skulking around out there, preying on the innocent, with my sights on their backs. I knew what she was thinking. Freedom conferred a certain solace. When it's only you taking care of your world, you feel as if you have some control over the many things that might go wrong. When you widen your circle to trust others, the risk increases exponentially. As if she'd just ended an inner debate on the same thought, Sarah Brady tensed, rising onto the balls of her feet again, trembling but determined. I shot Rainey a look that said, She's going to bolt. On cue, Rainey pushed the door to the townhome open all the way, allowing the scent of baking bread and a slowly simmering stew to waft out. I watched Sarah carefully. I'd had to drag a few kids inside, kicking and screaming, and had no problem doing so now. But more often than not, what words failed to accomplish, the promise of a hot meal did. It was easier for them in the long run if they took the first step willingly. Sarah, I'm hungry, the younger girl cried plaintively. I'm thirsty, and I need to pee. Just tonight, okay? Can we, oh, Sarah, please? Thomas chimed in. I'm cold. Sarah looked from my eyes to Rainey's and back again. Few adults probed gazes with such intensity, but the fate of her entire family was in her 11-year-old hands. I wanted to tell her how proud I was of her, that she impressed me with all she'd done to keep them alive and together, but Rainey would say all that and more. Okay, Sarah Brady said tightly. But just for tonight. One night, she repeated, glaring at her siblings. Once my charges were tucked safely inside and the door was closed, I smiled as I melted into the night. That was what they all said at first, then found their fears were no match for the breadth and scope of Rainey Lane's heart. Seeing Mac's mom was always uncomfortable for me, given the unspoken that lay between us. She'd never been anything but welcoming and kind. It was why I'd chosen to bring the first of the children to her and her husband Jack that bloody night months ago, and why I would continue bringing them, assured she would always grant them safe haven. Anyone that would welcome someone like me could never turn away a child. I tracked my prey into Temple Bar and out across the River Liffey and back again. Debating whether the trio was so powerful, so drunk or drugged, or just so bloody stupid, that they brazenly walked the killing fields of our city. Their deaths would save countless lives. Still, my sword hand itched so much for not being allowed to use it to kill the Fae now that Mac was queen, I'd begun to question my sentencing methods. I'd been taught a taste for the kill at a young age. Patterns like that are hard to break. I was good at it, and someone had to do it. Then Dancer died, and the finality of death took on new meaning for me. I still haven't found mercy, with the exception of kids and animals, but I've discovered creative sentencing. I had a few choice fragments of fairy, IFPs, Mac used to call them, I'd begun using for prisons. Speaking of my sword hand, it really was itching. And scratching it through my fingerless glove wasn't working, so I peeled it off. My palm was black and cold as ice. The last time I'd seen it this bad was years ago, standing in a cemetery, watching shadows explode from the graves. Shadows I'd been hunting for the past 2 years with no success. No one else had seen them that night, and no one had seen them since. I watched as the darkness spread, creeping around to the back of my hand, then shooting up into my fingers. A sudden sharp pain stabbed beneath all my nails. Black veins exploded up my wrist, vanishing into the sleeve of my jacket. I stripped off my coat. Inky veins and black streaks marbled my left arm, nearly to the shoulder. I was 14 when I stabbed a hunter through the heart with the Fey Hollow, the Sword of Light. The giant winged beast gushed black blood and shot me an incomprehensible look before closing fiery eyes. I thought I killed it. But when I returned to snap photos for my newspaper, the enormous dragon-like creature was gone. My hand turned to dark ice within the hour, making me worry something of the creature had seeped up my sword and infected me. I was enormously relieved when my hand regained its normal color and temperature a few days later. I'd since discovered spells work better when etched with that hand, and if, occasionally, I woke in the middle of the night to find it dark and freezing, I considered it a static oddity. It was no longer static. Something had changed. I waited to see if the darkness under my skin would continue to spread. When it didn't, I put my glove on and shrugged back into my jacket. There was nothing I could do about it. I couldn't unstab the hunter. I'd think about it later. My hunt took me in the direction of Baron's Books and Baubles. I liked seeing the lovely, spatially challenged bookstore that was sometimes 4 floors, sometimes 6, slicing the night, bastion eternal, spotlights blazing on the rooftop. It was a promise, made of timeless stone, polished wood, wrought iron, and stained glass. One day, Mac and Barons would come back. One day, I'd bang in that door again. One day, the people who mattered to me would return. Through the many disasters and riots that had befallen our city, even the Ice Age of the Hoarfrost King, Baron's Books and Baubles had remained untouched. I would be surprised to learn it had stood there since the dawn of time. There's a special feeling about the spot, as if once, a very long time ago, something terrible nearly happened at this precise longitude and latitude, and someone, or thing, dropped the bookstore on the gash to keep the possibility from ever occurring again. As long as the walls stand and the place is intact, we'll be okay. Some people have churches. I have BB&B. I turned a corner, anticipating the familiar sight, the rush of warm memories. The bookstore wasn't there. I narrowed my eyes, blinked, and looked again. Still not there. I scowled down damp, fog-wisped blocks at an empty concrete lot. Then I kicked up into the slipstream and devoured the distance, stopping shy of where the front wall of the bookstore should be. If the building was concealed with glamour, I had no intention of crashing into it. I sported fewer bruises these days and liked it that way. Beyond the empty lot, Jericho Barons' epic garage was gone too. In its place was another empty concrete-surfaced lot. My stomach clenched. I reached out and felt around. No wall.